Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, we talk plays. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, is here. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
And also Nelson Mitchell, who's associate professor of humanities at Mass Maritime Academy. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Full professor.
Oh, full professor now. Oh, see, you got a. Oh, great. Okay, good to know. And this is sort of a topic I don't think I would have thought of, Jill and Nelson, who you thought of this, picking up a play to read as you would a novel.
Well, I think Nelson picked this topic, and I think he should start. Yeah. Although I wholeheartedly went in on this simply because I have been reading plays since I was probably in junior high school,
and more recently have not
been reading plays. So this was a great treat.
All right, Nelson.
Well, plays can it's probably something that we don't read enough of, most of us. And plays, a fine play can read as well as a good novel. And to get us underway, I think we probably at least have a little nod to Will Shakespeare, little English writer at one time. And so instead of going down with Hamlet or King Lear or A Midsummer Night's Dream or something that might have led to nightmares when we were in high school.
I actually liked that in high school.
Well, we probably had a different experience with it. I thought I would talk about Twelfth Night, or its subtitle of What You Will. And Twelfth Night was originally performed in the Christmas season, so with the Twelfth Night of Christmas and that sort of thing. And so it's a comedy, there's some very famous lines. The play opens with Orsino, the Duke of Illyria, and the play is set in one of Shakespeare's Mediterranean exotic islands. And it starts off, "If music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it. That surfeiting, the appetite may stricken and so die. That strain again, it had a dying fall. Oh, it came over my ear like the sweet sound that breathes upon a bank of violets, stealing the and giving odor. Enough, no more. 'Tis not so sweet now as it was before." So, and Orsino's sort of a romantic duffer, and so he goes to he's obsessed with Olivia, and she's a lady, and so we're an aristocrat, and she lives in an estate, and her brother had recently passed away, and so she's in mourning and deep mourning, and she has one of the great Shakespearean comic figures lives in the house with her, a fellow named Sir Toby Belch, and as Belch would suggest, he does drink a bit, and there's the section in Act One, Scene Three when he's introduced, he comes in and with Maria, who's one of the servant women to Olivia, and Toby, "What a plague means my niece to take the death of her brother thus? I'm sure care's an enemy to life." And she's, "By my troth, Sir Toby, you must come in earlier at night. Your cousin, my lady, takes great exceptions to your ill hours." And so that all sets us up to a confrontation with Sir Toby and Malvolio. And Malvolio is the steward of Olivia's household. If we thought about Downton Abbey, Malvolio would be like Carson, that kind of thing. So, just to make that little connection, I suppose. So Malvolio takes his job very seriously. And there's undertones in the play that he's rather puritanical, of course, the Puritans were trying to shut down the theaters in Shakespeare's day, and they had to have most of the theaters outside of London. The Puritans controlled city government. Malvolio comes in at a night of when Toby's been rousing and with his friends drinking and making all sorts of noise. And he says, "Sir Toby, I must be round with you. My lady bade me tell you that though she harbors you as her kinsman, she's nothing allied to your disorders. If you can separate yourself and your misdemeanors, you are welcome to the house. If not, and it would please you to take leave of her, she is willing to bid you farewell." And so a bit more of an exchange. And finally, Sir Toby has one of the great comic speeches in the play. And it's a very short speech. And he says to Malvolio, he says, "Art thou any more than a steward? Dost thou think because thou art virtuous, there shall be no more cakes and ale?" And then it goes off from there. So it's a very funny play. And if one undergoes in reading it, and if there's a joke that you're not sure whether it's a body joke or not, assume that it is. There's a lot of that in the play.
Yeah, all right.
Well, and that's such a fun show. And I, was when I was between, I took a year off between high school and college and was actually part of this little Shakespeare group. And we used to just take scenes to high schools and do them.
Oh,
and one of them was 12. And I was like, make me a willow cabin at your gate and hollow your name. I mean, it's all sort of still somewhere in the back of my brain. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very interesting to me as I was putting this, my pile of books together for this show, was how rarely it is I read scripts anymore, and how I felt like I had missed huge pieces of theater in these years that I haven't been reading scripts. So this was a real opportunity to start reading things I had not read previously. But also, it is just a very interesting idea to me that you might want to read a play aloud. And you probably all have a lot of people in your houses right now, or will by tomorrow. So great opportunity to get the family to read a play together. And I've got some great ones here that might work.
That's a great idea because, you know, people are a little bit worried about getting together. There's always those family tensions and those conversations. Hey, let's do this play.
That's right. And there was this wonderful article in the New York Times that Dwight Garner wrote about why people aren't reading plays anymore. And even in my own library, I see that plays don't go out nearly as much as they used to. I went down to the children's room to see what they might have in the way of plays, because I remember checking out plays when I was a kid a long, long time ago. And it was astonishing to me. They had essentially nothing. I mean, like, they had one old book of plays of, like, fairy tales, and that was pretty much it, which shocked me. I expected to see, you know, shelves of kids' plays. But this article by Dwight Garner is called Submitting to a Play Spell Without the Stage. And he writes, not so long ago in America, keeping up with new plays was part of what it meant to be literate. And publishers did good business by stocking the drama sections in bookstores. New Directions published Tennessee Williams. Athenaeum made a bundle from Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Random House issued many plays in hardcover, including Oklahoma in 1943. Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman for Viking Press was a Book of the Month Club selection. If you didn't live near New York or couldn't afford tickets, you picked up the print editions if you wanted to be part of the conversation. Those days, sadly, are pretty much gone. Readers' eyeballs have fled elsewhere. New plays are hard to find in bookstores. They are issued, if at all, mostly by university presses and boutique publishers. The excuses for not theater going are easy to list. It's hell to find a babysitter, Netflix is a lovely narcotic, and it's hard to commit to loading that much money onto a Visa card. You could just about fly to Dublin and back for the price of a Broadway ticket and a decent meal. But what's the excuse for not reading some of these plays? And he goes on to talk about theater being a social and collaborative art form, and a playwright's work is no doubt most fully realized on the stage, but to encounter plays on paper is to encounter them in their platonic form. You're glued to the playwright's words, not sitting in row K jostling for an armrest while gawking at, say, Jane Fonda, wondering if all her years of aerobics paid off. While reading, you can submit more perfectly to the author's spell, and what's more, you are your own casting director. Ooh. And I think that's really true, that reading a play is so different from, wouldn't you say? I mean,
oh yeah, absolutely, yeah, because you go through the whole process. It begs you to visualize it, and we probably visualize it much more than we do when reading a novel. And we start to follow the characters, and yeah, and we cast them.
And, right, exactly. And who we think you get to cast who you think should be in any particular role. So I think it's a really great thing to be reading plays aloud, and that it's not something that anyone does a lot any longer.
Like I said, I don't think I've done it since high school, actually. You know?
Yeah, right.
Because it was assigned, right? Yeah.
Exactly, right. That's right. All those Shakespeare's that have been assigned to people, which may or may not have excited them about Shakespeare. So I tried to find plays that I had not seen, that I had not seen, that I had not heard of before, or had seen sort of in passing that they were very, you know, somebody was excited about them in New York. And mostly recent stuff, but not entirely. So one of the plays that I brought with me, which I just loved reading, and I'm sure this is a spectacular play to see as well, but it must be a lot of money to put it on. Although I will say, one of the things in reading these plays is apparently the number of people that are cast in a play has gone way down. I can only assume this is because prices have gone way up for hiring the best actors. This play, in fact, only has two characters. It's called Red by John Logan. And it is about the artist Mark Rothko and his assistant at the time that this play is taking place. And his assistant is also an artist, but you would never know that because Mark Rothko has no interest in the assistant at all, except in what he's, you know, only in what he's doing. And I love also that when you're reading a script, you see all these things, of course, that you would never know otherwise. For example, there is a special note at the beginning of this particular play. Rothko, for those of you who don't know, very famous artist who painted a lot of things in red, which is why the title is called Red. And in fact, the cover of the script is also red. But the special note is about the Mark Rothko images. And it says, these copyrighted images may be reproduced and used as background studio set dressing for production of the play. Due to strict quality control issues related to reproductions of these images, none of the panels may be fully displayed facing the audience at any time. So, I mean, these are things you don't necessarily think about when you're in the theater and you're looking at things. And here is his opening monologue, which is just fabulous. And it sort of it pulled me right in any case. And it's Rothko saying to his assistant, "What do you see? Wait, stand closer. You've got to get close. Let it pulsate. Let it work on you. Closer. Too close. There. Let it spread out. Let it wrap its arms around you. Let it embrace you, filling even your peripheral vision so nothing else exists or has ever existed or will ever exist. Let the picture do its work, but work with it. Meet it halfway, for God's sake. Lean forward. Lean into it. Engage with it. Now what do you see? Wait. So now what do you see? Be specific. No, be exact, but sensitive. You understand. Be kind. Be a human being. That's all I can say. Be a human being for once in your life. These pictures deserve compassion, and they live or die in the eye of the sensitive viewer. They quicken only if the empathic viewer will let them. That is what they cry out for. That is why they were created. That is what they deserve. Now, what do you see? And his assistant says, red, which is not exactly what Rothko was waiting for. And it goes on. It turns out that, in fact, he's designing these panels for this restaurant, the very, very fancy restaurant, where he's going to have his murals on the walls. And so there's a lot of discussion about what is art for? Why is he sort of selling out by putting these panels up in the restaurant? And in fact, he ends up I don't think I'm giving away too much because, in fact, everyone would know this if you knew much about Rothko. He ends up not doing this. But it is a really interesting conversation, and it is real. It's a two-character show, but totally engrossing to read because you don't really know what's going to happen. And it is really about one artist, well, two artists, one of whom is at the top of his world and the other one who's trying to grab onto that. Yeah. It's Red by John Logan.
Yeah, you know, you brought up a good point about, you know, being able to, like, visualize, you know, casting. And it made me think of, you know, my grandson's first play. I of course, want him to be educated in the arts. And, you know, at four, it's tough to get kids to sit through, you know, much theater. But he has this book, How I Became a Pirate. And last summer, the summer before, Cape Rep, the children's theater, I saw this. I was like, oh, we know this story. And success.
Oh, that's great.
So, I mean, that's a really great idea to kind of, you know, have this idea in your head, especially when you're trying to introduce kids to theater. Yeah,
right.
Exactly. All right, Nelson, what do you got next?
Okay. Well, I can't really talk about drama without going to George Bernard Shaw. So,
of course.
We
would disappoint it if you had not brought George.
Well, okay. Recently, my wife had a birthday earlier this month, and I gave her a new biography on Edith Nesbit, children's author in the late 19th century. And so she was a friend of Shaw's. So she mentioned it to one of her colleagues at work, and he had said to her, "All roads lead to Shaw." So with us, I suppose it doesn't. That's not why I got her the book. But anyway. So,
at least not consciously.
Not consciously. Yeah. Exactly. Though I have flipped through it. So, okay. So what I would brought in is one of Shaw's probably more popular plays, Pygmalion, and this, of course, was the play that was eventually adapted into My Fair Lady, and so yeah. Very, very popular. This is first premiered in 1914, and right, sort of on the eve of the Great War, or a few months before it, and one of the things that My Fair Lady does is sort of changes the ending of the play, and because we have Eliza, the flower girl that Henry Higgins has brought in and trained her to speak and so forth, and changed much of how she works and dresses and everything about her, and. And then, of course, in My Fair Lady, they sort of become a romantic couple at the end. And that's not what happens in Shaw's play. Shaw's play, they have to separate. They can't go. And so in a lot of the play takes on a whole different relevance now that we have in the Me Too movement, because it's very much about a man trying to control a woman. And so there's and of course the play has some very famous points. There's one point where Higgins brings her to his mother's house and have a first time put her into public, in a sense, a small group, and she's ready to leave, and this fellow that's a well-to-do social figure become very infatuated with her right away. And he asks her, "Are you walking across the park, Miss Doolittle? If so," and she cuts her, "Walk? Not bloody likely." And so bloody, of course, became a sensation at the time when it was first performed. And it was like a great shock that Shaw would put it on the stage. Eventually, Higgins takes Eliza to this grand event, and she does very well, and so forth. And when they come back to the house, Pickering, who's been helping Higgins, and they go on about their great success, and Eliza just sits there and listens, and it's like she's not in the room, of course. And finally, Pickering goes off to bed or so, and then we've got the two, and Eliza. Eventually, Higgins starts looking for his slippers. Eliza throws them at her, at him, and he says, "What the devil have you done with my slippers?" And then she throws one, and then she throws the other at him. So there are your slippers, and there, take your slippers, and may you never have a day's luck with them. And so Higgins is confused as why is this all about. And she says to him, "I've won your bet for you, haven't I? That's enough for you. I don't matter, I suppose." And Higgins says, "You won my bet, you. Presumptuous insect. I won it. What did you throw your those slippers at me?" And so it becomes a whole sense of who she is. And then Higgins would eventually say, "The creature, nervous after all," and of course referring to Shelley's Frankenstein and all of that. And so it gets a whole business where Eliza, she's her own person, and she wants trying to make sure Higgins understands that. And she says at one point, she says, "What's to become of me? What's to become of me? How the devil do I know what's become of you? What does it matter what becomes of you? You don't care. I know you don't care. You wouldn't care if I was dead. I'm nothing to you. Not so much as them slippers. Those slippers. Those slippers. I didn't think it made any difference now." And so because there's lots more into the play, and eventually Eliza says, "Well, what am I fit for? What have you left me fit for? Where am I to go? What am I to do? What's to become of me?" Because her whole life has been altered. And he says, "Oh, that's what's wrong." On this whole sense that she could marry and do quite well. And she listens to all this, and she says, and Higgins says, "Well, and I dare say mother could find some chap or other for you who would do very well." I said, "We were above that at the corner of Tottenham Road, Court Road." "Oh, what do you mean?" "I sold flowers. I didn't sell myself. Now you've made a lady of me. I'm not fit to sell anything else. I wish you had left me where you found me." And it just keeps going eventually. And of course, eventually, Eliza is going to go off. She leaves on her own. And she says, he said, "What are you going to do?" And she said, "I'm going to teach the language and teach people how to speak and phonetics." And of course, he's outraged at that. He says, I'll wring your neck. She says, "Ring away. What do I care? I knew you'd strike me. Now I know how to deal with you. What a fool I was to think of, not to think of it before. You can't take away the knowledge you gave me. You said I had a finer ear than you, and I can be civil and kind to people, which is more than you can. And of course, she just comes across as a total bully. And at the very end, after she's made her stand, Higgins says, oh, by the way, Eliza, order a ham and Stilton cheese, will you? And buy me a pair of reindeer gloves, number 8s, and a tie to match that new suit of mine at Fay Eel and Berman's. You choose the color. I says, buy them yourself. and she sweeps out of the room and out of the play. And Higgins' mother says, oh, she says, I'm afraid you've spoiled that girl, Henry. But never mind, dear. I'll buy you the tie and gloves. it's a great play. And if you know anyone really enjoys My Fair Lady, take Pygmalion or read.
Well, and I would have loved to have been at that meeting where they decide that they have to change the ending for the musical.
Yeah.
And they had to, Shaw had to be dead for that.
Yeah. All right, 866-999-4626 is our number if you have a suggestion for a play. And do you read plays? Let us know. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking plays this morning with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Nelson Richell, who's professor of humanities at Mass Maritime Academy. 866-999-4626 if you want to suggest a play for us. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we're wondering, as Jill's saying, those plays are disappearing from the library shelves. Do you read plays? We'd love to hear if you are one of those folks who do that. Jill, what's next on your list here?
Well, as a result of doing the show, I happened to read the theater section in a recent New Yorker, and decided I found another playwright I had never heard of, who is obviously very well known in the theater world. His name is Richard Nelson, and the plays that she was talking to. This was by Alexandra Schwartz, and it was a review of some of his plays, particular play she's talking about is a set of plays. It's three plays about this family. It's called The Gabriels. And the plays are just a family. Each one is a family at a particular time. It is just as the most recent election is happening. You may not want to read this one over Thanksgiving, but it is the third series in the play was actually performed the night of the election. And there's a lot of discussion in the family about the election that's coming up. However, it is very much not about the election as well, because it's about this family. It starts where the senior brother has died, but he has had three wives. Two of the wives are in the house for the funeral. His mother is there, his brother is there, his brother's wife, and they are all talking about who he was and what he was. And at the same time, every scene is in the kitchen, and so that they're cooking the entire time. I would love to see how they manage this on a stage. I mean, it must be fabulous. So they're cooking, and they're also reminiscing about everything that had happened with him, everything that had happened with the family, and also the politics of everything. And in the intro to this version of the play, it says, "But there is also hope in these plays, a deep and powerful hope, which springs not from politics or ideology, but from the love and connection of this family that we grow to know so well." Early on, Richard decided that the plays would be set in the kitchen and center on cooking. In each of the plays, the characters prepare and cook a meal on stage in real time, the sounds and smells of the food permeating the whole theater. In this magnificently simple way, Richard affirms the continuity and power of life and family. Cooking is not inherently dramatic. Food changes as it is cooked, but cooking has no reversals or dramatic action. Cooking sustains us physically and communally. Cooking is life-giving, and life is based on hope. It is the simple, small actions we take to sustain our communal life that give us hope that the world full of loss can nonetheless be good. That is from the intro to this play. And the family is cooking, and they're also having all these discussions about the past. They're also about to lose their house. There is also the issue that one of the children has gone off to college, but they're going to have him now take out about loans because they have to sell the house. And so there's all this sort of dark, and it all takes place in Rhinebeck, New York, which is not far from Bard College, where I went. Bard gets mentioned, Rhinebeck gets mentioned a lot, and how Rhinebeck has changed since the New Yorkers from the city have come and sort of started taking over. So it's a lot about what happens when a community changes. And I think a lot of that is actually quite pertinent to the Cape and what happens when a lot of people that are very well-to-do come and start taking over your town, as it were. But very beautiful dialogue, very beautiful conversations between them all. And must have been amazing to watch them cook all that food.
That is a really interesting idea, isn't it? To do actual food and actually cooking it on stage?
Well, and they're also going through all of the dead man's old stuff and boxes of old, because they're going to have to get rid of the house. And so there's this cookbook that they pull out that I, too, had as a kid. And they start making things from this cookbook, which was also very fun. So it's called The Gabriels, Election Year in the Life of One Family.
All right. Let's talk to Mary Chris, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Mary Chris.
Hello, Mindy.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling up. I'm enjoying this show immensely. I'm just one of the many people who do community theater around here. And when you mention plays that stand the test of time, that have so much meaning to read and to participate in, right off the bat, I thought of Shirley Valentine by Wally Isaacs. It was made into a film, but it's a one-woman show, Shirley Valentine, and it does stand the test of time. It takes place in Liverpool with a woman who has reached a point in her life where she just feels like she's been taken for granted. You know, mother of two almost grown kids, husband who just expects the same meal on the same days, and she's lost her identity. And the story is about the fact that how it gets back to where she was before. She was a bit of a rebel when she was a teenager, and she forgot about living. And she admired this girl in school who just seemed like she had it all together, and she has a reconnection with her later on, and the girl says, "Oh no, I admired you.
Grass is always greener, right?"
Right. And the whole process of her refinding herself. Basically, the story is that she is short version of a long story is that she gets an opportunity to go to Greece, and she, you know, and her kids say, "Mom, you know, no one goes to Greece except for sex." And she says, that's what I'm going to have. Guys and sex. Sex for breakfast, sex for lunch.
Great.
As it happens, she goes and she gets abandoned by her friend that she goes with. But she ends up having an incredible adventure and does rediscover herself and basically grabs life by her own terms. Yeah. And that show, I just witnessed women coming up and saying, "I love this show. I love it." Because that's what we all have to recognize, our uniqueness.
Yeah, Mary Chris, thanks. I had not heard of that before. Thank you for
I remember seeing
that.
The film.
Oh,
yeah.
You did? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very much sort of a response to the 1950s movement in England of the Angry Young Men plays with John Osborne and so forth, and with Richard Burton and all these actors that came out of it. So,
yeah. Mary Chris, thanks for that phone call. Yeah. If you have a suggestion for us, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. What have you got next, Nelson?
Well, since when we did the detective literature, we talked about Dashiell Hammett, and so it seemed only appropriate we would deal with his partner, and Lillian Hellman. And I think Lillian Hellman is probably a more important writer than Hammett. And Little Foxes is her play, and I think it's a really fabulous play and very much appropriate for our times now. And if we think about it, it was premiered in 1939. It's set in 1900. And the backdrop is a northern investment coming into the deep south to work in woolen mills and that sort of thing. So moving that industry out of the north essentially for cheap labor. And so it's the trading in cheap labor and so on. And so it deals with this family. They were in the hardware business, and they're going to build this factory with the northern money. And it's a family. There's two brothers and a sister. And so the three of them sort of connive and try to figure out how they're going to be. And, you know, if you think about the play in the late 1930s, coming through the Depression, and there are not very many likable characters in it. And so it sort of would have given audiences a view of those who still had through the 1930s and as opposed to the have-nots and so on. So, for example, there's one of the characters, Ben, who's one of the brothers and a very business schemer and so forth. And he says, about all this business, well, Henry Frick, you're Mr. Henry Frick, who said railroads are the Rembrandts of investment. Well, I say southern cotton mills will be the Rembrandts of investments. And so I give you the firm of Hubbard and Sons and Marshall Cotton Mills, and then the Hubbard family. So, and one of the great characters in it is Regina. And the film was the play was made into a film with Bette Davis, who played Regina. And still, a remarkable film, and because her performance in it is just superb. And it was a great character for her. And so she has a husband, Horace, and he's away for a bit. He comes back. He has very severe heart problems. And he doesn't want to invest in this new mills. And he controls the money that they could put up. And so he comes back and he needs medication. And he's come out of the hospital early. He probably shouldn't have come out. And he needs the bottle of the pills. And Regina doesn't get them. She helps him. And so he says to her before, at the start of all this, he says, why didn't you leave me? Because they're going on about how awful, you know, she's complaining of the marriage and so on. And then she says, well, I told you I married you for something. It turned out it was only for this. This wasn't what I wanted, but it was something. I never thought about it much, but I had. But if I had, I'd have known that you would die before I would. But I couldn't have known that you would get heart trouble so early and so bad. I'm lucky, Horace. I've always been lucky. I'll be lucky again. And he's reaching for the bottle, and she doesn't, you know, she just watches him. So he's on a stair landing, and he's collapsed, and he's trying to get the bottle. He's calling for the servant, but he can't speak very, very loudly. And she just waits and waits. So it's a terrible play in that regard, but it's a great it's a wonderful play in the sense that it gives us a very interesting window into American history at the time, and of course Hellman's politics would have been toward the left anyway, but then of course she was railroaded into the McCarthy era in the 50s and all that, and which is very unfortunate because she did her wrote a lot of really important plays in the 1930s, and we didn't get that really didn't carry over later on. Late, and she would write those great autobiographies later on in her life. But it's a wonderful play. There is a point. There is a positive part at the end when her daughter represents the hope, and she says, and Addie's one of their servants. And of course, because it's in the South, and the racism is there, but it's meant to give us a view of how grotesque these people are. And one of the servants, Addie, who raises the teenage daughter, Alexander, she's really her mother in all intents and purposes. So anyway, Alexander says to her real mother, she's Regina, she says, at the end of the play, she says, well, Addie said there were people who ate the earth and other people who stood around and watched them do it. Ben said the same thing, really. He said the same thing. Well, tell him for me, Mama. I'm not going to stand around and watch you do it. Tell him I'll be fighting as hard as he'll be fighting. Someplace where people just don't just stand around and watch. And, of course, that's the message of the play.
Ooh, very good. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more plays after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking plays this morning with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Nelson Richel, professor of humanities at Mass Maritime Academy. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Margaret is giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Margaret.
Hello. Thank you. This has been a wonderful, wonderful show. I'd just like to make a comment that George Bernard Shaw wrote a fantastic, honest play in which we saw how patriarchy is the problem. And this woman, once she found herself, she was no longer going to buy into it, in contrast to My Fair Lady. Mm. And so, therefore, Me Too, in my view, is confronting patriarchy. And they're not buying into it anymore either. And I think it is the only way our culture, which is so rotten with sickness because of it, sick men dominating, Me Too is saying no more. So I think while it looks like a tough time to be alive, especially for, you know, a woman, and I have four daughters, I had a fantastic time.
Yeah.
And I thank you very much for the show.
All right, Margaret, thanks. Thanks for calling and sharing your thoughts on that. We appreciate that. 866-999-4626. If you'd like to chime in, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. My voice holds out. One more segment, we'll be okay. Right? All right, Jill, what have you got next?
Well, I was delighted to discover a play I didn't know about. This is an older play, and somehow I had missed this. I have read a lot of Gertrude Stein, and this play is called Gertrude Stein, Gertrude Stein, Gertrude Stein. And it was a one-woman play. It must have been extraordinary. It got extraordinarily good reviews. And it is essentially Gertrude Stein is about to be evicted from her apartment. And it is this just one long, long monologue of what's going on in her life at that time. And it's very funny because even this is, again, where when you read the play, there are things you just don't get if you're watching the play. So, for example, here's an act one. These are the stage directions at the beginning of the play. And the stage directions are, and again, only if you know something about Gertrude Stein, like to repeat herself a lot. So act one is the stage description is incidental music, incidentally, incidental music, and incidentally, incidental and incidental, incidental music, and incidentally. All right, then. Lights. The studio at 27 Rue de Fleurus in Paris, 1938. Heavy wooden furniture, particularly the high-back throne-like Renaissance armchair and the long table strewn with artifacts and piles of books counterbalanced at one end by a single, huge Webster's Dictionary. China pieces of questionable good taste adorn the mantel, and the walls are covered up to the high ceiling with modern oil paintings on canvas. Some are framed and some are not. Rainfall and a gentle rumble of distant thunder. And Gertrude Stein. Simultaneously, she is wearing her long brown corduroy robe, is sitting in her armchair quietly smoking a cigarette and pondering aloud, incidentally, there's the sound of rain and distant thunder. So I mean, obviously none of that is what you actually get to hear when you're in the theater, but you're seeing it all. And it begins with, as I said, with her eviction. And she is saying, it is, it always is, and it always most certainly is an inconvenience being evicted. I know, and we were. Alice did not like it. Alice Toklas. And she said so. She said, who are you to be telling us our home today is to be someone else's home tomorrow? And he said, I am the landlord, madam. That is who I am and who he was and he is. And we are evicted. And that, as they say, is that. And the landlord's son moves in tomorrow. Well, anyway, and she goes on to talk about her life. And she talks, there's a little bit about Matisse's housekeeper, for example, which is very funny. Sentences and words are a passion, and they do not just happen. They evolve gradually. And that usually takes until dawn. Then I would go to bed and sleep until noon to be awakened by the sound of beating of rugs in the courtyard, which was as disagreeable as it was effective. But Helene, the housekeeper, had her own set of passions. For example, she did not care for Matisse. Her omelets and souffles were her specialty. But for Matisse, she always fried the eggs. It requires the same amount of eggs and butter, she said, but it lacks respect. And then there's a funny thing about writing a book. You know, she writes, it is a funny thing creating a book is you make it and you make it for yourself and for strangers and you make it by working hard and it becomes your life then. And then one day you are finished and you want to show it to everyone and you're afraid to show it to anyone. And someone looks at it and reads it. And you wonder if they will say yes or no. Yes is what you want, of course. It is always very pleasant, yes. But no is what every writer, every artist is afraid of. Anyway, very fun, very lovely, fun piece on Gertrude Stein called Gertrude Stein, Gertrude Stein, Gertrude Stein by Marty Martin. And how she learned all the lines for this script, I cannot imagine. Because there's nobody else on stage with her. She is just herself, it's yeah. one very long monologue. But wow. It must have been great fun to watch it and got great reviews when it was out.
All right. Nelson, what's next?
Well, just to go back to the Shaw's collar for a moment. I mean, Shaw's, there's a lot of, he was always very strong for women's rights. He wrote a very interesting play, Getting Married, about 1905, 1906. And, Shaw at that time viewed marriages a lot of marriages were vehicles for men to entrap women, and that women didn't have the rights within those. So he was always very conscious of that, and he tried. And so certainly with Pygmalion, he tries to give us a good glimpse of how Higgins has tried to control and create what Elijah is, and at the end of the play. Wonderfully, is that she has none of it. She goes, and that's the heart of the play. And also, you know, Mrs. Warren's Profession, which does get a lot of performances or reproductions as well. That's another great play on women. But anyway, okay, so next is a great classic American play from Eugene O'Neill, A Long Day's Journey into Night. So, as Hellman had the connection with Martha Vineyard, so now we've got O'Neill with a connection to Provincetown and all that. And so this is the O'Neill's great play that deals with his family, the torturous childhood he had, and so forth, dealing with his father, who was a well-known actor in the 19th century, who had been a rising star, performed with Edwin Booth and so forth. But then he purchased the rights to an adaptation of The Count of Monte Cristo, and he started performing it over and over, and it made a lot of money for him. But it wrecked his career. It got to a point where no one wanted to see him in anything but The Count of Monte Cristo. And in the household, it's all set in the home in Monte Cristo Cottage in New London, Connecticut, where O'Neill, their summer home, and O'Neill's mother had become terribly addicted to morphine and other drugs. And his brother Jamie alcoholism and so forth. So there's a play that, and what goes through in the play is all the characters go through the experience. And Edmund, who represents O'Neill, and Edmund was the name of his younger brother, brother who died before he was born, and so that was always something that was on O'Neill's mind. So we get to there's a scene towards the end of the play where we have a long night with the father, James Tyrone, and Edmund, and they come to terms, and they start to, and they're having a little drink, and they're starting to open up. And this is one of the great speeches, and I won't read the whole thing, but just part of it. But James says, "I've never admitted this to anyone before, lad, but tonight I'm so heartsick, I feel at the end of everything. And what's the use of fake pride and pretense? That goddamn play I bought for a song and made such a great success in. A great money success. It ruined me with its promise of easy fortune. I didn't want to do anything else. And by the time I woke up to the fact I'd been a slave to the damn thing and to try other plays, it was too late. They identified me with that one part and it didn't want me in anything else. They were right, too. I lost the great talents I had once had." He goes on and on about that. And he gets a little further down. He says, "I studied Shakespeare, as you'd study the Bible. I educated myself. I got rid of an Irish brogue you could cut with a knife. I loved Shakespeare. I would have acted in his plays for nothing, for the joy of being alive in his great poetry. and I acted well in him. I felt inspired by him. I could have been a great Shakespearean actor if I'd kept on. I know that. In 1874, with Edwin Booth, came to the theater in Chicago where I was leading man. I played Cassius to his Brutus one night, Brutus to his Cassius the next, Othello to his Iago, and so on. The first night I played Othello, he said to our manager, "That young man is playing Othello better than I ever did." And then he gets to the Andersons. But it was a great box office success from the start. And then life had me where it wanted me. From 35 to 40,000 net profit a season. A fortune in those days. And even in these. Well, what the hell was it I wanted to buy, I wonder? That was worth. Well, no matter. It's a late day for regrets.
That's a great speech, yeah. Great. Hey, Jill.
Well, I wanted to mention a couple of women playwrights who are currently writing and who are writing really exciting, interesting plays. I've never seen any of them. I would love to see all of them. They all sound fascinating. And one of them is Sarah Rule, and the other is Annie Baker. And both of them have just had these wonderful careers that I had not read any of them. And Sarah Rule's, one of her plays is called The Clean House, and here's how it's described. She was inspired with the idea for it at a cocktail party. A doctor walked in and said, "I've had such a hard month," she remembered. "My cleaning lady from Brazil wouldn't clean, and I took her to the hospital and got her medicated, and she still wouldn't clean. So I had to clean my own house. I didn't go to medical school to clean house." I thought, "What does this mean about gender and about class?" Ms. Rule said. I thought, "What about the poor woman? Is she clinically depressed or does she just hate cleaning?" In the end, she said, "The question is, how much responsibility do you have, not just literally for the mess of your own life, and how much do you try and avoid chaos?" In many ways, Ms. Rule said, the play is about cleaning as transcendence, spiritual cleansing. The Clean House had dozens of stagings around the country and abroad and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2005. The doctor in the play, it is in fact this doctor and his maid. And one of the, you start reading, it's funny right from the beginning. This maid really wants to be a comic, but most of her jokes are in Portuguese, so they don't understand them. And the sister of the wife really loves to clean, and so she comes in without telling, but the maid doesn't like to clean, and so the sister's coming in to do the cleaning because she loves to do it so much, but the maid wants to be a stand-up comedian, and that's the setup for the play. And it's really fun. It really talks a lot about the roles of women, the roles of the rich and the not rich. Really fun play called The Clean House, and I would love to see more Sarah Rule. And what that Sarah Rule also wrote this fabulous little book, which I had also not seen, called 100 Essays I Don't Have Time to Write on Umbrellas and Sword Fights, Parades and Dogs, Fire Alarms, Children and Theater. Most of them are very short, given that there's going to be some big parades tomorrow. Here's one that she wrote called Everyone is Famous in a Parade. "I love watching my children watching parades. They seem to love the simple act of some people walking down a street while other people stand still and watch. I think it must be the most basic, simple form of theater. Very little storytelling and a distinction between the watcher and the watched. No one in the parade is a famous actor, but they are all famous in the moment because they happen to be moving and the other people happen to be standing still." I was just so sweet. And she has another one, which is all about snow on stage, which is very funny. Children as dramaturgs. They're great little fast essays. And I think everyone will find something to enjoy in this book. It's called 100 Essays I Don't Have Time to Write.
And you mentioned the parade tomorrow or Thursday. That's tomorrow. Yeah.
Yes, that is tomorrow.
The cold brain going here. And we might not have the floats, they're saying, because of the wind.
Oh, the balloons. Yeah, yes. The balloons are always in. Yes.
Yeah, so let's keep our fingers crossed that the wind dies down a little bit so we can have those.
Absolutely.
Those balloons. And believe it or not, that's it. We're out of time. So we will have a link to all of the books we talked about, the plays that we talked about this morning, at our website, capeandislands.org. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Nelson Michelle, Professor of Humanities at Mass Maritime Academy. As always, thank you both. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.